Chapter 24. Webb had not read a paper in several days. He finally bought a copy of the Washington Post and went through it over coffee at a table near the large fountain at the Reston Town Center. He had been making slow circles of the Washington metropolitan area and racking up some serious motel bills for the bureau. Webb occasionally looked up and smiled at the kids climbing up on the ledge and throwing pennies into the fountains while their mothers held onto their shirt tails so they wouldn't go plunging into the water. He had gone through sports, metro, style, working his way backward to the front section. On page A6, his nonchalant attitude disappeared. He reread the article three times and looked closely at the accompanying photos. When he sat back and digested it all, he found himself coming to conclusions that didn't seem possible, so far-fetched were they. He touched the damaged side of his face and then pressed a finger against the spot of each bullet hole. After all this time, was he going to have to confront it again? He punched his speed dial. Bates wasn't in. Webb had him paged. The guy called back a few minutes later. Webb told him about the article. Louis Ledbetter. He was the judge down in Richmond who tried the Free Society case. Gunned down. Watkins was the prosecuting attorney in the case. He goes in his house and it implodes. All on the same day. And then you got Charlie team. We were the team that responded to the Richmond field office's request. I killed two of the freebies myself before I got my face toasted and two holes in me. And then you have Ernest B. Free himself. Busted out of prison, what, 3 months ago? One of the guards was paid off, got him out in a transfer van, and ended up with his throat slit for his trouble. Bates' reply was surprising. We know all that, Webb. We've had our computers crunching that stuff, and then those two deaths, murders, happened. And there's something else.
What?
You better come on down. When Webb arrived at the WFO, he was escorted to the Strategic Operations Room that had all the bells and whistles one would expect at the deep-pocketed, crime-busting federal behemoth, including the standard-issue, copper-coated walls, sophisticated interior security system, white noise at all vulnerable portals, retinal and palm scanners, stacks of high-powered computers, video equipment, and most important, fresh coffee in high quantities and a mound of hot Krispy Kreme donuts. Webb poured himself a cup and said hello to some of the folks scurrying around the large room. He looked at computer-generated diagrams of the courtyard and its environs that had been tacked to large boards and mounted on the walls. There were pins at various places on the diagrams that represented, Webb knew, significant points of evidence or clues. The bustle of feet, the nonstop clack of computer keys, the ringing of phones, the rustle of paper, and the ballooning body heat index told Webb that something was up. He had been part of these war room operations before. Oklahoma City set the standard way too high, said Bates with an ironic smile as Webb sat down across from him. Now everybody expects us to examine a few hunks of metal, check a few videotapes, run a few plates, hit some computer keys, and bingo, we have our man hours later. He dropped his legal pad on the table. But it almost never works that way. Like everything else, you need some breaks. Well, we just got a bunch telegraphed to us. Somebody definitely wants us to know he's out there.
I'll take a lead however it comes in, Purse. Whoever it is can't control how it's followed up.
You know, I really hated it when you left WFO to go climb ropes and shoot big guns. If you'd stuck with me, you might have made a decent FBI agent one day.
You make your bed, you lie and die in it. You said there was something else?
Bates nodded and slid a news clipping over to Webb, who looked down at it.
Scott Wingo. That name rings a bell.
Yeah, he defended our friend, Ernest B. Free. I wasn't at the trial, of course. I was still recuperating. But the guys who were there talked about Wingo. Slick and smart. He cut his guy a sweetheart deal. And now he's dead.
Murdered?
Atropine was applied to his telephone receiver. You pick up the phone. You naturally press it against your skin, near your nostrils and such. atropine is absorbed through the membranes much faster than via the bloodstream. Causes your pulse to go into overdrive, breathing constricted, can make you hallucinatory, all within an hour or so. If you have bad kidneys or other circulatory problems, so the body can't quickly rid itself of the stuff, that would speed up the poison's effect. Wingo was diabetic, had heart problems, and was confined to a wheelchair, so atropine was the perfect choice. He went in alone on Saturdays, so nobody would be around to help when he started feeling the atropine hit him. And on weekends, he was known to return a lot of calls, or so the folks in Richmond tell us.
So whoever killed him knew both his medical history and his work routine.
Bates nodded. Ledbetter got shot when he turned on the light to read an article another judge supposedly told him about. The marshal who took the call said it was a Judge Mackey. Of course it wasn't.
The phone again.
That's not all. Watkins' neighbor was pulling out of his driveway at the time Watkins was walking up to his house. He told police that he saw Watkins reach into his pocket and pull out his phone. The guy couldn't hear the phone ringing, but he said it looked like Watkins was answering a call. Gas in the house, he hits the talk button. Boom.
Webb said, "Wait a minute. A cell phone isn't like a light switch. It doesn't have the right type and amount of electrical spark to ignite gas."
We examined the phone, or what was left of it. The forensic folks actually had to scrape it off Watkins' hand. Someone had planted a solenoid inside the phone that would cause the exact type of spark necessary to ignite that gas.
So somebody had to snatch his phone, probably while he was asleep or away from it for any length of time, plant the solenoid, and then they had to be watching him when it happened to get the timing that exact.
Yep. We checked the logs for Watkins and the marshal's phones. Both calls were made with disposable calling cards you buy with cash and then discard. No record.
Like undercover agents use. I take it yours hasn't surfaced yet.
Forget our undercover.
No, I'll just come back to him later. So what's the latest on Free?
Nothing. It's like the guy's gone to another planet.
Is the organization still active?
Unfortunately, yes. You probably remember they disavowed being part of the hit on the school in Richmond, and Ernie wouldn't rat on his soulmates, said he'd planned the job himself without their knowledge, so there went that case. The other gunmen were dead, two of them thanks to you. We couldn't crack any of the other members and get them to testify, so the Free Society was never even charged with anything. They laid low for a while because of all the negative publicity, but word is they're coming back with fresh blood.
Where are they now?
Southern Virginia, near Danville. You better believe we've got that place covered. We figured old Ernie would head there after his escape, but so far nothing.
After all this, can't we get a search warrant for their headquarters?
What, we go to the magistrate and say we've got 3 murders, 6 if you count Watkins' family, and we think this Free Society might be behind them, but we've got absolutely no evidence linking them to the hit on HRT or anybody else. Wouldn't the ACLU just love to hit that one out of the park?
Bates paused.
It all makes sense, though. Prosecutor, judge, perfect motive for revenge.
But why the defense lawyer? He saved Ernie from lethal injection. Why take him out?
That's true, but you're not talking about rational people, Webb. For all we know, they're pissed because their fellow madman served 1 day in prison. Or maybe Ernie had a falling out with the guy, and when he got out, he decided to take them all out.
Well, at least that should end the killings. There's nobody left.
Bates reached in a file and pulled out another slip of paper and a photograph. Not quite. You remember there were 2 teachers gunned down at the school, too.
Webb took a deep breath as the painful memories came flooding back. And the boy, David Canfield.
Right. Well, one of the slain teachers was married. And guess what? Her husband was killed 3 days ago in Western Maryland while driving home late one night from work.
Homicide?
Not sure. It was a car crash. Police are still investigating. Looks like a hit and run.
Telephone involved?
There was one in the car. After we contacted them, the police said they would check the phone logs to see if he received a call right before the crash.
How about the other teacher's family?
The husband and kids moved to Oregon. We've contacted them, and they're under 24-hour surveillance right now. And we're not stopping there. You remember David Canfield's parents, Bill and Gwen? Webb nodded.
I was in the hospital at MCV for a while. Billy Canfield came to visit me a couple of times. He's a good guy. He took the loss of his son really hard. Who wouldn't? I never met his wife, and I haven't seen Billy since.
They moved. Live up in Fauquier County now, run a horse farm.
Anything strange happened to them?
We contacted them as soon as we made the connection. They said nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. They knew about Free's escape. And to quote Bill Canfield, he said he doesn't want our help, and he hoped the bastard came after him because he'd just love to blow his head off with a shotgun.
Billy Canfield is no shrinking violet. I could tell that when he came to the hospital to see me. Rough, tough, and opinionated. Some of my team who testified at the trial told me he was a pretty loud presence there, too. Came close to contempt citations a couple of times.
He ran his own trucking firm and then sold it after his kid died.
If the Frees are behind the killings in Richmond, Fauquier County is a lot closer than Oregon. The Canfields really could be in danger.
I know. I've been thinking of taking a ride out there and trying to talk some sense into them.
I'll go with you.
You sure about that? I know that what happened to that school in Richmond is something you'd be better off not revisiting.
Webb shook his head. That's not something you ever put behind you, Purse. I don't care how much time goes by. The two teachers died before we got there. I couldn't do anything about that. But David Canfield was killed on my watch.
You did more than anybody could have, including almost getting killed. And you got a permanent badge from it right there on your face. You have nothing to feel guilty about.
Then you really don't know me.
Bates studied Webb closely. Okay, but let's not forget about you, Webb. If wiping out Charlie Team was the Free's goal, they haven't accomplished it yet. You're the last man standing. Barely, thought Webb.
Don't worry, I look both ways before crossing the street.
I'm serious, Webb. If they tried once, they'll try again. These people are fanatics.
Yeah, I know. Remember, I got the permanent badge.
And another thing. At the trial, Wingo filed that countersuit against HRT and the Bureau for wrongful death.
That was bullshit all the way.
Right. But it allowed them to take some discovery on HRT. The Free Society probably learned some things about your methods, procedures, and such. It could have helped them in setting up the ambush.
Webb hadn't considered this yet. It actually made a lot of sense. I promise if I get any weird-ass phone calls, you'll be the first to know. And I'll check my receiver for atropine. Now, tell me about this undercover. Maybe the Frees are involved, but they had to have some inside help. Now, I know he's black, and it's hard for me to believe the Frees would work with a man of color, but we can't afford to discount anything right now. You told me Cove was a loner. What else do you know about him?
Webb hadn't heard back from Ann Lyle on his inquiries into Cove, so he had decided to go right to the source. Oh, lots of stuff. It's right in that file over there, marked FBI Undercover Agents, All You Ever Wanted to Know.
Purse, this guy could be the key.
He's not. Take my word for it.
All I'm saying is I worked these kind of cases. And contrary to what you think, I didn't forget how to be an FBI agent when I joined HRT. I had a great teacher, and don't let that swell your head. And another pair of eyes is another pair of eyes. Isn't that what you always beat into me?
That's not how it works, Webb. Sorry. Rules are rules.
I seem to remember you telling me differently way back when.
Times change. People change. Webb sat back and pondered whether he should play his trump card.
Okay, what would you say if I told you something you don't know but that could be important?
I'd say, why the hell didn't you tell me before?
I just figured it out.
Yeah, right.
Do you want to hear it or not?
And what's in it for you?
I give you info on the case, you do the same for me.
How about I make you tell me for nothing?
Come on, for old time's sake.
Bates tapped the file in front of him.
How do I know it's really something I can use? If it's not, then you owe me nothing. I'll trust your judgment. Bates eyed him for a few more moments. Go. Webb told him about the switch with Kevin Westbrook. As he went on, Bates's face grew more florid, and Webb could tell the man's pulse was nowhere near 64 and had probably left double digits far behind. When exactly did you figure this out? And I want it to the minute. When I was having a beer with Romano, and I mentioned that the Kevin Westbrook I saw had a hole in his cheek from a bullet wound. The kid he had, he said, didn't. Cortez corroborated that. And don't go after those guys. I told them I'd fill you in ASAP. Sure you did. Who would switch the kids, and why? Not even a good guess. But I'm telling you, the kid I saved in the alley and the kid Romano turned over to the alleged FBI agent were two different boys. He tapped the table. So what's your judgment? Worth it or not? In answer, Bates opened a file, although he recited the facts from memory. Randall Cove, age 44, been with the Bureau his whole career. He was an All-American tailback from Oklahoma, but blew out his knees before the NFL draft. Here's a recent photo. Bates slid it across and Webb looked at the face. The guy had a short beard, dreadlocks, and eyes that could only be described as piercing. The vitals said he was a big man, about 6'3", 240. He looked powerful enough to take on a grizzly and maybe win. Webb hunched forward, and while he pretended to study the picture in greater depth, he was actually reading as much as he could from the file Bates had open. His years as an FBI agent had left him with many tricks to help his short-term memory retention until he could write things down, and he had also become very proficient at reading upside down. Bates said he could take care of himself, knew the street better than most kingpins, and cool under pressure. Yeah, Princeton whitebreds named William and Jeffrey just never seem to fit in with Drugtown USA. I wonder why, said Webb. You mentioned before that he didn't have a wife or kids, so he never married?
No, his wife's dead.
And they didn't have kids?
He did.
What happened to them?
Bates shifted comfortably in his seat.
It happened a while back.
I'm all attention.
Bates let out a long breath and didn't seem like he was going to start talking.
I lost my whole team, Purse. I'd kind of appreciate full disclosure here.
Bates sat forward and clasped his hands in front of him. He was working an assignment in California. Heavy cover because it involved the Russian mob. Those guys will fire a missile up your ass for coughing around them. They make the mafia look like preschoolers. Bates stopped there.
And?
And his cover got blown. They traced his family.
And killed them.
Slaughtered would be more like it.
Bates cleared his throat.
I saw the photos.
Where was Cove?
They had intentionally diverted him away so they'd have a free hand.
And they didn't go after him, too?
They tried, later. They waited until he buried his family, nice guys that they were. And Cove was waiting for them when they came.
And he killed them.
Bates started blinking rapidly, and Webb noted a sudden tick over the man's left eye.
Slaughtered. I saw those photos, too.
And the Bureau just let this guy keep working?
What, they don't believe in early retirement for agents with butchered families?
Bates spread his hands in resignation.
The Bureau tried, but he wouldn't go. He wanted to work. And to tell you the truth, after what happened to his family, the guy worked longer and harder than any UC we ever had. They transferred him to WFO to get him out of California. Let me tell you, he got into places we were never able to get into before. We got convictions on serious, large-scale operators all across the board because of Randall Cove.
Sounds like a hero.
Bates finally smoothed out his tic. He's unorthodox, goes his own way a lot, and the higher-ups can only take so much of that, even from the undercover dudes, slaughtered family or not. But none of it really stuck to Cove. I can't say it hasn't hurt his career. I mean,
It's not like the Bureau has a place for a guy like this outside of undercover, and I'm sure he knew that too. But he plays the Bureau games, always covered his back. You take the dirt with the good, and the guy always delivered. Until now.
And the trace on his family by the Russians, would that have been in any way the Bureau's screw-up?
Bates shrugged. Cove didn't seem to think so. He's been plugging away ever since.
You know what they say about revenge, Purse. It's the only dish best eaten really cold.
Bates shrugged again. Possibly.
Webb was just starting to get worked up.
You know, it just gives me the warm fuzzies that a guy like that was able to stay in the Bureau and maybe lead my team down the primrose path to Armageddon to avenge his wife and kids. Don't you guys have some kind of quality control over this shit?
Earth to Webb, undercover agents are a different breed. They live a lie all the time, and sometimes they get in too deep and get turned, or just go nuts all on their own. That's why the Bureau switches people in and out, changes assignments, and lets them recharge their batteries.
And they did all that with Cove? Switched him out, let him recharge his dreadlocks, gave him crisis counseling after he buried his family?
Bates was silent on this.
Or was he so good at his job that they just let him keep rocking along until he finally erupted all over my team?
I'm not going to discuss that with you. I can't discuss that with you.
What if I told you that was unacceptable bullshit?
What if I told you you were getting way too close to the line? The men glared at one another until the fires died down.
And his snitches? Were they all pro too? Asked Webb.
Cove always played it close. He had access to them only, not anybody else. That's not exactly Bureau procedure, but like I said, you couldn't argue with the guy's results. Those were his rules.
So, we know any more about this target? You said it was the financial guts of some drug op. Whose?
Well, there's some difference of opinion about that.
Oh, swell, Purse. I love a puzzle at both ends.
This stuff is not an exact science, Webb. The area where your mission went down is controlled pretty much by one crew, Big F's. I told you that.
So it was his operation we were hitting in that building.
Cove didn't think so.
He didn't know for sure.
What, you think the bad guys carry union cards or ID reading, I'm a member of X crew?
So what was Cove's opinion?
That the money operation was that of a much bigger player. Maybe the ring supplying a drug called OxyContin to the DC area. You heard of it?
Webb nodded. DEA guys talk about it all the time down at Quantico. You don't have to drug lab the stuff or worry about sneaking it past customs. All you have to do is get your hands on it, which you can a dozen different ways, and then start printing money.
A criminal's nirvana, added Bates dryly. It's one of the most potent and frequently prescribed painkillers on the market right now. It blocks pain signals from the nerves to the brain and gives you a feeling of euphoria. Normally, it works on a 12-hour time release, but if you crush it or smoke it, you get a brain rush that some say is almost equal to heroin. It also can throw the abuser into respiratory arrest, which it has frequently.
Nice little side effect. Are you telling me you have no idea who his inside guy might have been?
Bates tapped the file in front of him. We have some ideas. Now, this is totally unofficial.
At this point, I'll take rumors and lies.
For Cove to get in as deep as he was, we figure the snitch has to be in the inner circle, pretty tight. He was working the Westbrook angle when he stumbled into the Oxy piece. But I have to presume that whomever he was using to infiltrate Westbrook's operation is the person who helped him get onto this new development. Antoine Peebles is Westbrook's COO, for want of a better term. He runs a damn tight ship, and it's largely because of him that we haven't been able to lay a finger on Westbrook. Here's Westbrook, and the other one is Peebles. He slid across two photos. Webb looked at them. Westbrook was a monster, far bigger even than Cove. He looked like he'd been through a war. His eyes, even staring out from the paper two-dimensionally, had the keenness that you always saw in survivors.
Peebles was an altogether different picture.
Westbrook is a warhorse. Peebles looks like he should be graduating from Stanford.
Right. He's young, and we figure Peebles is the new breed of drug entrepreneurs. Not as violent, more businesslike and ambitious as hell. Word on the street is that someone's looking to band all the local distributors together to make them more efficient. Enhanced bargaining power up the line, economies of scale, a real business approach to it.
Sounds like old Antoine may want to be CEO instead of just COO.
Maybe. Now, Westbrook came up through the streets. He's seen and done it all, but we've heard that he may be looking for an exit from the drug business.
Well, Peebles may have a different agenda if he's the one behind the organization of the local crews. But giving away valuable stuff to Cove doesn't exactly figure with being the heir apparent. If you bust the operation, what does Peebles have left to run?
That's a problem, conceded Bates.
Who else is in the picture?
Westbrook's main muscle, Clyde Macy. Bates handed him the photo of Macy, who, to put it kindly, looked like he should be taking up space on death row somewhere. Macy was so white he looked anemic, a skinhead with the sort of calm yet merciless eyes that Webb associated with the worst serial killers of his experience.
If Jesus saw this guy coming at him, he'd scream for a cop.
Apparently, Westbrook only works with the best, commented Bates.
How did Macy fit in with all the brothers? He looks like a white supremacist.
Nope, apparently just doesn't like hair. We don't know much about him before he came to D.C. Though we could never prove it, he was believed to be a foot soldier for a couple kingpins who got sent to federal Shangri-La in Joliet. After that, he came to D.C. and joined Westbrook. He has a well-deserved rep on the street for loyalty and extreme violence. A real crazy ass, but professional in his own way.
Just as any good criminal should be.
His first big act of malice was putting a meat cleaver in his grandma's head, because he claimed she was shortchanging him at dinner time.
How come he's walking around free after a murder rap like that?
He was only 11, so he did time at a juvie detention center. Since then, the only crime the guy's committed is 3 speeding tickets.
Nice guy. Mind if I keep these photos?
Help yourself. But if you run into Macy in a dark alley or a well-lit street, my advice to you would be to run.
I'm HRT, Purse. I eat guys like him for breakfast.
Right. Keep telling yourself that.
If Cove's really as good as you say, then he didn't just walk into an ambush. Something else is going on.
Maybe, but everybody makes mistakes.
Did you confirm that Cove didn't know when we were coming?
I did. Cove was not told the date of the hit.
How come he didn't know?
They didn't want any leaks, and he wasn't going to be there anyway, so he didn't qualify as a need to know.
That's great. You didn't trust your own undercover. That doesn't mean he couldn't have gotten the information from another source, like WFO.
Or like HRT, Bates shot back.
And the potential witnesses being there, was that intel from Cove?
Bates nodded.
You know, Purse, it would have been nice to know all this up front.
Need to know, Webb. And you didn't need to know that to do your job.
How the hell can you say that when you don't have a damn clue how I do my job?
You're getting close to that line again, my friend. Don't push it.
Does anybody give a damn that 6 men were killed in the process?
In the grand scheme of things, Webb, no. Only people like you and me care.
So, anything else I don't need to know?
From his large stack of documents, Bates pulled out a very thick, expandable file, slid out one of the manila folders, and opened it.
Why didn't you tell me Harry Sullivan was your old man?
Webb immediately rose and poured himself another cup of coffee. He didn't really need the extra caffeine, but it gave him time to think of a response or a lie. When he sat back down, Bates was still looking over the file. When he glanced at Webb, it was clear Bates wanted an answer to that question before he would give up the material.
I never really thought of him as my father. We parted company when I was barely 6. To me, he's just a guy.
After a moment, he asked,
When did you find out he was my father?
Bates ran his finger down one of the pages. Not until I pulled your entire background check file. Frankly, looking at this arrest and conviction record, I'm surprised he had time to get your mother pregnant. Lot of stuff in here, he added enticingly.
Webb wanted to snatch the file out of Bates's hands and run from the room. However, he just sat there, staring at the upside-down pages, waiting. The bustle of the room had receded for him now. It was just him, Bates, and, on those pages, his father.
So why are you suddenly so interested in, as you say, just a guy? Asked Bates.
I guess you get to a certain age, things like that start to matter.
Bates put the folder back and slid the entire file across to Webb.
Happy reading.
Chapter 25. The first thing Webb noticed when he got back to the motel was that there was a fresh oil patch in the parking space he had been using. Nothing unusual, really, for another guest could have used that spot, though it was directly in front of Webb's unit. Before he unlocked the door, he checked out the doorknob while pretending to fumble for his room key. Unfortunately, even Webb could not tell if the lock had been picked or not. It hadn't been forced, but somebody who knew what he was doing could pop the simple lock in the time it took to sneeze and leave not a trace. Webb opened the door, his other hand on the butt of his gun. It took him about 10 seconds to discover that no one was in the tiny room. Nothing was out of place, and even the box he had taken from his mother's attic was there, each piece of paper exactly where he had left it. However, Webb had 5 different types of tiny booby traps set up throughout his room, and 3 of them had been tripped. Over the years, Webb had developed this system whenever he was on the road. Well, whoever had searched his room was good, but not perfect. That was comforting, like knowing the 400-pound brute you were about to rumble with had a glass chin and occasionally wet his bed. Ironic that while he'd been meeting with Bates, someone had searched his room. Webb had never been naive about life, because he had seen the worst of it as both a child and an adult. Yet the one thing he had always thought he could count on was the Bureau and all the people who gave it life beyond the technical forms and guns. For the first time in his career, that faith had been shaken. He packed his few belongings and was on the road within 5 minutes. He went to a restaurant near Old Town Alexandria, parked where he could see his car through the restaurant's window, ate his lunch, and made his way through Harry Sullivan's life. Bates had not been joking. Webb's old man had been a guest of some of the finest correctional facilities the country had to offer. Most of them in the South, where Webb knew they grew some exceptionally fine human cages. His father's offenses were myriad, yet had a common theme. They were typically low-level financial crimes, business scams, embezzlement, and fraud. From some of the old court transcripts and arrest records in the file, Webb could see his old man's main weapon had been a smooth tongue and more chutzpah than any one human being should be toting around. There were various photos of his father in the file, from the front, right, and left sides, with the little line of prisoner identification numbers running underneath. Webb had seen many mugshots of arrested people, and they all looked remarkably the same. Stricken, terrified, ready to slice wrist or blow out temple. Yet in all his mugshots, Harry Sullivan was smiling. The bastard was grinning, like he had put one over on the cops, even though he was the one busted. But his father had not aged well. He was no longer the handsome man he had been in the photos in the attic box. The last series of shots showed a very old man, though he was still smiling, albeit with fewer teeth. Webb had no reason to care about him, yet it was difficult for him to witness the man's decline in all its impersonal Kodak glory. As Webb read some of the trial testimony of his father, he couldn't help but laugh in places. One slick operator emerged from the lines of dialogue as the cagey con battled with prosecutors determined to put him away. "Mr. Sullivan," asked one DA, "is it not true that on the night in question you were..."
"Begging your pardon, lad, but what night would that be again? Me memory's not what it was."
Webb could almost see the lawyer rolling his eyes as he answered, "The 26th of June, sir."
"Ah, that's right. Go on now, lad. You're doing fine. I'm sure your mum's proud of you."
In the transcript, the court reporter had typed parenthetically, "Laughter in courtroom." "Mr. Sullivan, I am not your lad," replied the lawyer.
"Well, forgive me, son, for I'm not quite experienced in such matters, and I surely meant nothing by it. Truth is, I don't know what to be calling you. Though in the ride over from the jail to this fine courthouse, I heard others call you names I wouldn't be saying to me dearest enemy in the world. Words that would have made me poor God-fearing mum roll over in her good Catholic grave. Attacking your honesty and integrity. And what man can be standing for much of that?"
"I could care less what criminals say about me, sir."
"Begging your pardon, son, but the worst of it be coming from the guards."
"Laughter again," the stenographer had typed. "Huge thunders of laughter," Webb concluded, judging from the regiment of exclamation points tacked on the end.
"Can we continue, Mr. Sullivan?" said the lawyer.
"Ah, now, you'll be calling me Harry. It's been me name since me Irish arse came into this world."
"Mr. Sullivan." This came from the judge, Webb read, and in those two words he seemed to sense a long laugh, though Webb was probably wrong. But the judge's last name was O'Malley, and perhaps he and Harry Sullivan shared a hatred of the English, if nothing else.
"I certainly won't be calling you Harry," said the lawyer,
and Webb could almost see the righteous indignation on the man's features for having to carry on such a conversation with a common criminal and getting the worst of it.
"Well now, lad, I know it's your job to put me old withered self into a cold, dark cell where men treat other men with no dignity at all, and all over a wee misunderstanding that might amount to nothing more than bad judgment, or perhaps a pint or two more than I should have had. But even so, you call me Harry, for though you've got to see this terrible deed through, there's no reason we can't be friends."
As Webb finished the file on that particular chapter in his father's life, he had to note with some satisfaction that the jury had acquitted Harry Sullivan on all counts. The last crime his father had been sent to prison for had gotten him 20 years, by far his longest sentence. So far, he had punched 14 years of the time in a prison in South Carolina that Webb knew to be a sweat hole one short step from hell, and he had 6 more years to go unless he got paroled, or more likely, died behind bars. Webb took the final bite of his pastrami and the last swallow of his Dominion ale. There was one more file to check. It did not take long to read, and left Webb stunned and even more confused. The Bureau was good. They left no stone unturned. When they checked somebody's background out, damn it, man, you were checked out. If you were applying to work at the Bureau in any capacity, they talked to everybody you had any contact with in your entire life. Your first grade school teacher, your paper route manager, even the pretty girl you had taken to the prom and subsequently slept with. And they had no doubt also spoken with her father, to whom you had to explain your miserable conduct afterward when the secret got out, even though it was his innocent little girl who had ripped off your pants and brought the extra lubricated condoms. Your Boy Scout troop leader, your in-laws, the bank manager who had turned down your first car loan, the woman who cut your hair. Nothing, absolutely nothing, was sacred when the FBI was on the case. And damn if they hadn't managed to track down old Harry Sullivan. He had been newly ensconced in his little South Carolina retirement cell, and he had given the background checking agents his 2 cents on Webb London, his son.
"My son."
It was a phrase Harry Sullivan had used 34 times during the meeting because Webb took the time to count them. Harry Sullivan gave my son the best damn recommendation anyone could give another person, though he had only known my son for the first 6 years of his life. But according to Harry Sullivan, a proper Irishman could tell if my son had what it took from nearly the day the diapers came off. And his son had what it took to be the finest FBI agent there ever was or ever would be, and they could quote him on that. And if they wanted him to come up to Washington to tell the powers that be that very thing, he gladly would, though it would be with leg and arm shackles he'd be trooping in, yet his heart would still be bursting with pride.
There was nothing on earth that was too good for my son.
Webb continued reading, and his head dropped lower and lower as he did so, and then finally it almost hit the table with Harry Sullivan's last written statement.
"And would the good agents, the fine agents," he'd begun, "mind telling my son that his father has thought about him every day over all these years, never once letting him out of his heart, and though it was not likely that they would ever hook up again, that Harry Sullivan wanted my son to know that he loved him and wanted the best for him, and to not think too badly of the old man for how things had turned out? Would the good agents mind telling my son that? For he'd be much in their debt if they did. And he would be proud to buy them each a pint or two if the opportunity ever arose, though the prospect did not look at all promising for that, given his current living arrangements, though one just never knew. Well, they never had told Webb anything. Webb had never seen this report until right this minute. Damn the Bureau. Was there never any room to bend the rules? Did everything have to be lockstep, their way or the highway? And yet Webb could have discovered this information years before if he had really wanted to. He just hadn't wanted to. The next thought that hit Webb made his features turn grim. If the Bureau had sent Claire Daniels Webb's file, was she already privy to some or all of this information regarding Harry Sullivan? If so, why hadn't she bothered to tell him that? Webb packed the file up, paid his bill, and walked back to the Vic. He drove to one of the Bureau's motor pools, switched vehicles, and drove a late-model Grand Marquis out another gate, not visible from the street he had come in on. The Bureau wasn't exactly rolling in available Bue cars, but the Grand had come in for a 10,000-miler, and Webb had persuaded the supervisor that he deserved a nicer set of wheels than the 20-year vet uptown at HQ the car was assigned to. If anyone had a problem with that, Webb had added, go talk to Buck Winters. He's my best friend.